Hello, and welcome to Literally from the North Shore. Thank you for tuning in. Today, we will continue with Tom Kohler's reading of Minnesota author Dean Hovey's book, Whistling Pines, a lighthearted mystery set in a fictional Two Harbors senior care facility. We'll pick up where Tom left off last time.
Whistling Pines, Chapter 9. Len Rentz was standing at the reception desk, checking out all the names on Sunday's visitors list, starting with the earliest visitor that day. He dragged the list back to my office, first grilling me on the connections and then calling the outliers to ascribe them to a resident. He asked them if they'd heard or seen anything unusual during their visit. Most all of the visitors were local, with a few from as far away as Hinckley, about 75 miles to the south. Len leaned back from the list. There were 29 people who signed the visitor's book between 11:45 and 12:30, and they all attended Stella Ahonen's birthday party. I hit seven names that didn't have local phone numbers, and all had very Finnish names. Here's my neighbor Janet. Maybe she can fill in the blanks. Len dialed his cell phone. Janet, this is Len Rentz. I'm following up with all the Whistling Pines visitors from the day of Axel Olsen's death. I see your name on the visitors log. He pressed the speakerphone button. Hi, Len. I was there for Grandma's birthday party. I guess I hadn't connected the dots between the party and the murder. What's up? I was wondering whether you were in the building and if you'd seen or heard anything unexpected. Well, the party was in the dining room, and I didn't go anywhere except there. She paused, then laughed. The only unusual thing I saw was my Aunt Hedwig open her blouse to show everyone her prosthetic breast. She invited everyone to see how natural it felt. I was thinking more in the line of criminally strange things. Nope, I didn't see anything like that. I just remember all the little old ladies lined up to squeeze Aunt Hetty's fake boob. Len rolled his eyes, and I stifled a laugh. Geez, Janet, now I've got that in my head, too. You didn't really need to share that, he said with a chuckle. Let me try a different question on you. I've got seven very Finnish names on the visitor's log, but none of them are local. Any chance they were at the birthday party, too, and that you might be able to get me their phone numbers or addresses? Len read the names from the list. They would probably be Aunt Stella's Finnish cousins. They went back to the cruise ship in Duluth as soon as the party was over, and I don't know how you'd contact them. Uncle Arvid Lotti probably has addresses and phone numbers for them once they get back to Finland, but I think they're supposed to be on the ship for another few days before they fly back home. I can probably get you the names and phone numbers of the people that I remember at the party. That'd be helpful. I'm not sure that everyone signed in, and I'd like to talk to anyone who was in the building. Janet rattled off the names she remembered, and Len picked up four people who hadn't signed the log. I appreciate the help, he offered after scribbling down the names and addresses, then cross-referencing them with the list. Say, Len, can I suggest something? Sure. I think you should get one of those police belts that have a strap that goes over your shoulder. You really don't have enough hips to hold up that belt of yours, and I saw one with a strap on Barney Fife last night, and it seemed to be working for him. Thanks, Janet. I have a snap ring sewed onto my belly button that attaches to the buckle, so I don't have problems with it falling down. Cool. Did you have that done at the mall in Duluth, where they pierce ears? I'm kidding. Thanks for the help. Jenny's head ducked in my door. What are you doing here? She asked me, after registering surprise at Len's presence. It's your day off. The ghosts woke me up this morning and told me I had to find Axel's murderer. Jenny shook her head. You get 2 days off a week and you decide to use them chasing murderers? You need to get a life. With that, she was gone. Len was smirking and shaking his head. "It's all your fault," I said to him. "I was perfectly happy to go home and be lazy, but you wanted someone on the inside." "Do like I do," he said. "Put in for comp time to make up for the hours you work on a day off." "Len, there is no comp time in my job description. If I'm stupid enough to be here on my day off, it's my own fault, and Kathy isn't going to give me other time off." "I have the same problem with the city council," Len said, reaching for the phone. "But it sounds like a good idea when I tell people about it." Len was about to hang up after the eighth ring when Arvid Lotti answered the phone with a sleepy voice. "Arvid, this is Len Rents. I was hoping that you could help me out a little with some addresses." "Who is this?" Arvid yelled. "Hang on a second while I put in my hearing aid." There was a long pause, followed by an electronic shriek that sounded like microphone feedback. "Okay, now who did you say you were?" "Len Rents from the police department." "Oh, hi, Len. What can I do for you?" "I spoke with your niece, Janet Peterson, and she said that you might be able to help with addresses and phone numbers for the Finnish visitors at Stella's birthday party." "Janet's a nice girl," Arvid said with a chuckle. "Works pretty hard for herself. I treat her just like my full-blooded Finn relatives, even though her dad was a Swede. You really wouldn't know that she was from a mixed marriage like that, would you?" "Most people don't consider a Finn marrying a Swede a mixed marriage, Arvid." "Well, you know what they say about Swedes, don't you? You can tell a Swede, but you can't tell him much." Arvid laughed at his joke. "The Swedes and Norwegians say the same thing about the Finns." "Well, they got no count saying anything like that. They're just jealous that we're so right so much of the time." "Arvid, can we get back to my original question? I'd like addresses and phone numbers for the Finnish visitors at Stella's party, and Janet said you might have them. Is that true?" "They weren't going back to Finland directly, you know. They were on that tour boat that was going up to Thunder Bay and then to Marquette, Michigan." Arvid pronounced Thunder Bay with a silent H. "I seen on the television that a whole bunch of them tour folks were sick with the trots and got off to go to the hospital." "Well, I'd like to get numbers for them. I'll try to phone them in a week or two if I still need to. You're not thinking that these folks had anything to do with that guy who died at the nursing home, are you? They're all in their 80s and had to have a couple of their kids along to help with the walkers and such. They're probably not suspects, but they might have seen or heard something. They all got cataracts and hearing aids. They'd be lucky to be able to hear the dinner bell. I tell you, Len, I think you'd be better looking for somebody a little younger." "What time did you get to the party, Arvid?" "Well, I don't surely know. It was before the food got put out, so I suppose that it was a smidge before noon or so. I was about the third one in line, so I got a full portion of all the hot dishes before they got picked over. I can't say I cared much for their rye bread. I guess it was okay for store-bought stuff, but it weren't nothing compared to when Stella made her limpa rye. Now that was some good bread. I can picture her walking around the table with that big, flat loaf tucked under her arm, carving off hunks as she passed around the table. She was some fine cook." Len listened patiently and waited for a break in the monologue. "But did you see anything strange that day, or maybe someone who looked out of place?" "Well, there was something that struck me as odd. They made the rice hot dish with beef instead of venison. It just didn't taste right with beef. I suppose I can understand if they had a bad hunting season, but for a special occasion to be serving beef is pretty odd." Len grimaced and rolled his eyes, again waiting for a break. "Did you know Axel Olsen?" "Oh, yeah. Everyone knew Axel. He was an A number one ass, if you'll excuse my French." "What made you feel so bad about him?" "He thought he was a big man, and he was always trying to show somebody up. I remember back in the 60s when I was cutting wood for the pulp mill and trying to raise a family. He had this big tract of pulpwood down by Carlton. It was getting old and starting to die out like it does right before the birch trees start taking over. Well, I offered him top dollar for the stumpage, but he must have thought he could get more. He wouldn't let me cut there. He never let anyone cut it. Just let it all die and fall down.
Did you ask him why he didn't let anyone cut there?
Oh, he said that he didn't want me breaking up the roots of the birch trees that were coming in. But it seemed that he took some sort of strange joy in knowing that I was in a pinch and that he could make it a little harder for me. He made some sort of commotion about Jack Pine Finns, who should figure out how to get a real job. Like I said, he was an A number one ass.
Len interrupted, saying, Axel had a few pieces of land around the area. Did you know how Axel made the money to buy the land he had?
I'm not sure about that. It's not like he ever farmed or logged any of it. I guess I'd assumed he inherited some money somewhere, because it sure didn't seem like he ever worked very hard at the bar business. Mostly I remember him sitting around the VFW and Moose Lodge telling people how much money he had.
Was he a good family man?
Like I said, he was an ass, Arvid said with a snort. He treated his wife Enid and the kids like he owned them. He always had a nice car and nice clothes, and his kids and wife walked around town with clothes that had patches on the patches. I don't know why she stuck with him all those years, except that was the way some men were back then. A lot of wives didn't have much to say. Not like today.
Say, Len, I just found the list I had of the Finnish addresses and such. I'm coming into town for a bite of lunch, and I could stop by the police station. I suppose you might have a copier there, so you could make a copy and leave me with the original?
Thanks. Stop by City Hall and talk to Shelby. I'll go over right now and tell her that you're coming by in a bit.
Len shut down the speakerphone and shook his head. The Finnish connection is probably a dead end, but you have to track down every thread.
Len, if you're trying to convince me to be a cop, you're not making it sound very appealing.
It's not running around town with sirens and red lights, Len said. Well, I suppose there's the coffee and the donuts.
Whistling Pines, Chapter 10.
Oh, Peter, could you come over here for a minute?
Edith McAllen was gliding down the hall with her new rolling walker that featured a built-in seat. A non-profit group, funded by a mining trust, ran Whistling Pines. They subsidized rent and provided walkers and wheelchairs for the needier residents. Edith followed the birch handrail as she tottered her way toward me. Because of artificial knees and poor equilibrium, she could have been easily mistaken for a drunk.
"What can I do for you, Edith?"
"Well," she started somewhat breathlessly. She was wearing a red knitted sweater and well-worn purple polyester slacks. "I'm a little bit concerned about this thing with Axel. I've been keeping my door locked, and before I go to bed, I put a little stack of aluminum cans against the door so they'll fall over and wake me if someone breaks in and tries to kill me. But I was thinking about calling my son and asking him to bring over a deer rifle that I could keep by my bed."
Swirling visions of little old ladies carrying deer rifles to the dining room passed through my head. My next thought was that we might have to buy bulletproof vests for the staff. My third thought was to check the resident's handbook to make sure there was a clause forbidding firearms in the building. There was a sign next to the front door that said guns were prohibited on the premises, but the residents might think that's only for visitors. My mind was racing with ugly possibilities.
"Now, Edith, no one's going to break into your apartment and do you harm. You don't need a gun, and I don't think that we allow the residents to have guns in their rooms anyway."
"I've got a right to protect myself, and it sure seems that if Axel had a gun, he'd still be alive. He was a war hero, you know. He probably would have shot that guy who shot him. Instead, the killer is still roaming the halls and probably looking for his next victim."
"Axel wasn't shot, Edith, and I'm pretty sure that the person who killed Axel wasn't a resident."
Edith gave me the evil eye with one lid partially closed. She drew in a deep breath and was ready to say something when Howard Johnson came around the corner.
"Hello, Edith," he said. He nodded to me as he passed. He moved smoothly, his white-haired head held high. Even his shoes had a luster that made me believe they'd seen a shining cloth that morning. In an effort to change the topic, I threw out the first thing that came to mind. "I've got a sign-up list for people who want to ride the shuttle to Axel Olsen's funeral." Howard stopped and looked over his shoulder at me. "I doubt that you'll need a big van. I suspect you'll have a hard time filling a Volkswagen Beetle if you limit it to people who would claim Axel as their friend." His pace quickened as he left. "Are you going to the funeral, Edith?" I asked, thinking back to Howard's earlier comments. "I haven't decided yet. I might go just to hear the bagpipes." "Where did you hear that there are going to be bagpipes?" "It was all the talk at lunch. I guess they had to go all the way to Thunder Bay to find a decent piper who knew how to play Amazing Grace." "Wendy and I are in charge of the funeral music, and we don't have any plans for bagpipes," I explained. "Yep, I heard that you and Wendy were trying to squash the bagpipe idea, but I guess the family is making all the arrangements in spite of you." "I'll tell you what, I'm going to call Axel's son right now to see if he knows anything about bagpipes." "I guess you'd better, Pete, 'cause you'll sure look silly trying to sing some hymn when the bagpipes come marching in playing the Charge of the Light Brigade." "The Charge of the Light Brigade is a poem, not a song. Half a league, half a league, half a league onward, all in the valley of death rode the 600. Edith frowned and then tottered away humming the Battle Hymn of the Republic, which I suppose could be confused with the Charge of the Light Brigade if your memory is a little off kilter. After my discussion with Edith, I searched out Wendy to see what she'd been planning for funeral music. I found her sitting at a dining table with a corner of the linen tablecloth peeled back and the bud vase pushed aside. She was concentrating on a crossword puzzle and sipping a glass of Mountain Dew. The other 15 tables were neatly set up for the next meal, a red or white carnation on each table. Wendy was backlit by the large windows that gave peaks of Lake Superior across the expansive lawn. The grass was still brown, waiting for a few warm days of sunshine. A dozen hundred-year-old white pines swayed as the lake winds ripped through their branches. The architect who designed Whistling Pines had been standing under those trees, surveying the property when a wind came up, creating a whistle through the pines and providing him with the name Whistling Pines. Edith McAllen cornered me and we got into a discussion about Axel's funeral music, I said as I slid a chair back from the table and sat down. She's convinced that we're going to have bagpipes. Did you know that Edith's nickname was Busty? Wendy asked, not looking up from her puzzle. Who told you that? I asked, trying to picture a younger version of Edith with an expansive bosom. Edith did when I was helping her fill out medical assistance forms. Now she says that it's a race to see whether it's the right one or the left one that gets to her knees first. Wendy gave me her Cheshire Cat smile, knowing it would take hours to banish that image from my mind. I heard chuckling from behind me and turned to find Miriam drawing a cup of coffee from the urn. One of our old cows has teats that almost drag on the ground when she's out grazing. Can we move this discussion in another direction? I asked. Miriam frowned. I thought you were the one who started the conversation about Busty McAllen. The door to the patio opened and Becky, one of the high school girls who worked part-time in the kitchen, came inside, Tucker leading the way. Tucker was straining at the leash and nearly dragging her. The contest was still undecided until Tucker stepped on one of his own ears and did a slow somersault. I'm getting so tired of taking Tucker out to pee on the bushes. Can't we find someone who will take him home? Becky asked. Miriam looked as if she'd suddenly forgotten something in the kitchen, and Wendy's puzzle was suddenly more interesting. What's a five-letter word for pismire? Wendy waggled a number 2 pencil between the fingers of her right hand.
There were teeth marks all over the yellow paint. What? I need a 5-letter word for Pismire, she said, pointing to a spot near the bottom of the puzzle. It's here in the puzzle, and it looks like the second and third letters are M. She turned the puzzle so I could see the open boxes around the two M's. See, it says Pismire, she said, pointing to the clue with the tip of her pencil. I have no idea what a Pismire is, and we really need to talk about bagpipes, I said in exasperation. Wendy cocked her head and stared at the clues, totally ignoring the bagpipe issue. If you know a famous sports writer whose name starts with C-O-S, I could get the first letter of Pismire. Howard Cosell is the only sports writer I know of whose name starts with C-O-S. C-O-S-E-L-L. That would mean that Pismire starts with an E-M-M and two blanks. What's the rest? Wendy, listen to me, I said, grabbing the pencil from her hand. We have to talk about funeral music. It seems that everyone thinks we're going to have bagpipes, and I don't know a thing about it. Geez, don't get your undies in a bunch just because you don't know the word for Pismire, she said, snatching the pencil back. I thought you went to college to get a huge vocabulary so you'd know how to use words like Pismire to impress people. Bagpipes, talk to me about bagpipes. I don't know where you found them, but the residents are pretty much pumped up about the idea of bagpipes at the funeral. She continued to study the puzzle. If a typical shower present is a layette, and that fits all the other ways, then the last letter in Pismire is a T. I haven't got bagpipes. I didn't plan to get bagpipes, and I'd like to know who started the rumor that there's going to be bagpipes at the funeral. I've got it. With Maeve as Prince Arm's wife, that makes Emmett the answer to Pismire. That seems kind of stupid. I wonder if Pismire is somebody's last name. I snatched the puzzle and pencil from Wendy's hands and held them behind my back. Tell me if you've arranged for bagpipes for the funeral. I thought you were taking care of the bagpipes, she said, with a shocked look on her face. I've got an opening hymn and a vocal solo, but I thought that since you were lining up bagpipes that they'd be best for the recessional. I know they only have 9 notes, so that really limits the songs they can play, but I've heard Amazing Grace on the pipes, and they give it a real mournful edge that befits a funeral. I closed my eyes. There are no bagpipes. There are going to be a lot of disappointed old ladies who are looking forward to hearing bagpipes at the funeral, she said, stealing the pencil back and jabbing it into the air for emphasis. If you couldn't find a piper, why did you tell all the people that there are going to be bagpipes? That's what I'm trying to tell you, Wendy. I didn't tell anyone that we're having bagpipes. I have no idea where the rumor came from. I handed the crossword puzzle back to her. I thought maybe it was something that you or the family had arranged. Not me, she replied, sliding the crossword back onto the table. Hey, do you know a 4-letter word for the Hawaiian state bird that starts with N? The second letter might be an E. Plan for something other than bagpipes for the recessional, I said, pushing myself back from the table. Focus on something that can be played on the organ. It might be Nini, but that hardly seemed like the name for a bird. She looked up with a twinkle in her eye. Tell you what, I'll check with the organist to see if she can set the organ to sound like bagpipes, and I can play Amazing Grace for the recessional. Now, how about Loch Lomond? You know the song, you take the high road and I'll take the low road. I threw up my hands. Whatever. My mind was on the non-existent bagpipes when I stepped out of the dining room and into Len Rents. He managed to put his hand on my chest in an effort to avert being bowled over by my mad rush. Easy, Peter. Oh, I'm sorry, I said, catching his arm in time to stop his spin. I'm a little stressed out over bagpipes. I heard something about bagpipes, Len said as he reestablished his footing. It seemed a little strange for a Swedish funeral. Come with me, I said, waving Len into the director's office. I closed the door. I'm not sure where that rumor started, but there are no bagpipes.
It's funny how rumors grow by leaps and bounds when you get a bunch of people in a closed community. We have the same problem in the city offices. I don't imagine you came here to talk about rumors. Let's go up to Axel's apartment and look around again, Len said, reaching for the door. The room is sealed, I said, as Len walked to the elevator. The people from the state are through. They released the scene, Len said, pushing the elevator button. We won't be disturbing any evidence. The elevator doors opened and Maud Thibault hesitated for a second when she saw Len's uniform. She looked up at his face and smiled. Lenny, how are you? She stepped out far enough to block the doors and put her hand on Len's arm. You weren't the brightest boy in third grade, but people say that you're a pretty good policeman. Thanks for the encouragement, Mrs. Thibault. I try to make up for my shortcomings by being thorough and diligent. She patted Len's arm and stepped past him. That's probably the most you can expect from you, coming from a German family and all. I looked for an explanation, but Len nudged me toward the open elevator. When the door closed, he smiled. Mrs. Thibault was a young woman whose parents were killed in France during the German occupation. She didn't have much time for Germans, and since my parents were the only family in Two Harbors with a German name, we caught a lot of her wrath in and out of school. The elevator door opened, and we stepped into an empty hallway. My father and grandfather both proudly served in the U.S. Army, but Mrs. Thibault was more interested in her festering German hatred than in facts. We stopped in front of Axel's door, and Len pulled away the yellow crime scene tape. But it's not just her. My father fought the Japanese in the Pacific and saw some things that he won't talk about to this day. My brother was looking at a new Toyota Camry a couple of years ago, and my dad told him that no son of his would ever own a Jap car. I pulled out my ring of keys and unlocked Axel's door with the master key. So, did your brother buy the Toyota? Nope, and we never talked about it again.
You've been listening to Episode 5 of Whistling Pines by Minnesota author Dean Hovey. There will be a total of 15 episodes in this reading, so be sure to tune in again next time for more from Whistling Pines. If you miss an episode during the reading of this book, you may find the previous week's episodes posted each weekend on our website, ktwh.org, under the Programs tab near the top of the home page. Just look for Literally from the North Shore on the drop-down menu under Programs.